From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Jose Torres remembers the punch that ended his career. Torres is the former world light heavyweight champion and the author of a new biography of heavyweight champion Mike Tyson. Also today, towns caught between fear and compassion. David Kirp has studied how communities decide whether or not to let children with AIDS attend public school. Blues musician John Hammond joins us in our weekly performance spot, and Stuart Brand has a travelogue about his recent journey to cyberspace. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The Navy canceled today's test of the Trident II missile after two ships from the anti-nuclear group Greenpeace refused to leave the firing area. Two Greenpeace ships and two motorized rafts had been shadowing the submarine USS Tennessee in an attempt to block the test. Greenpeace spokeswoman Sharon Fagan says one of the rafts pulled alongside the submarine.
We were within 200 yards of the submarine with our ships, and we took a Zodiac up to the sub mast. It was submerged, but the mast shows above the waterline, and we put a flag on it that says nuclear free seas.
Greenpeace has tried to block the test of the $40 billion Trident II missile because the group says the missile will continue to expand the nuclear arms race into the world's oceans at a time when land-based missiles are being reduced. The Navy says the test will be rescheduled. A former official at the Department of Housing and Urban Development said today that he had made recommendations to the agency that benefited developers who later hired him at $125,000 a year. Joseph Monticello of New York, the New York Regional Administrator from 1981 to 1988, contradicted earlier testimony before a House panel investigating allegations of fraud, abuse, and influence peddling at HUD during the Reagan administration. Chinese students meeting in Chicago this weekend, hoping to form an organization, an opposition in exile opposing the government of Premier Li Peng. They're meeting the first Congress of Chinese students and scholars in the United States, NPR's Jackie Leiden reports.
What the students here want to show the world most is that they haven't abandoned the pro-democracy movement, along with the fight for Tiananmen Square. The 1,200 conference participants were galvanized this morning by a hero of the resistance movement, Wu Kaixi, who recently escaped from China. He stood in front of a replica of the Goddess of Freedom and urged the students to preserve the pro-democracy movement in exile. He spoke through an interpreter.
But some say China is hopeless at this moment. I want to say the hope is just beginning. The hope is great.
Not all the students are in agreement about what should be done next. Some are conservative. Some want to overthrow the government of Premier Li Peng. But as one student leader said, our different opinions mean we are already practicing democracy. The conference adjourns Sunday. I'm Jackie Leiden in Chicago.
The State Department said today Secretary of State James Baker is not interested in having a formal bilateral meeting with Chinese Foreign Minister Qian Qichen in Paris. But spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler did not rule out the possibility that the two leaders might happen to have informal private talks. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was fractionally lower at 26.35. This is NPR News. President Bush today welcomed into the Republican Party a self-described conservative Democrat. Representative Tommy Robinson of Arkansas charged there's no room in the National Democratic Party for Southern conservatives. Robinson's entrance into the party through White House doors, followed by one day Bush's Oval Office welcome of retiring Washington, D.C. Police Chief Maurice Turner, a lifetime Democrat who turned to the Republican Party. The Central Committee of Poland's Communist Party began a plenary session today in Warsaw. One party leader in charge of the economy has already turned in his resignation. Jane Dobia reports.
Central Committee member Władysław Waka today told his comrades he cannot function in a government with inflationary policies. The Socioeconomic Commission Baca heads up has released a report that sharply criticizes the government of current Prime Minister Mieczysław Rakowski. Under Rakowski's direction, Poland's budget deficit has swelled. Observers say Baca is one of the most likely candidates for the new prime minister. President Wojciech Jaruzelski is expected to name his choice for the post during the plenary session. Jaruzelski hinted last week that he might step down as first party secretary. He has made no such move as yet. The plenary session ends tomorrow. Then Jaruzelski's candidate for prime minister must be approved by the National Assembly. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
The Soviet news agency TASS reported today 11,000 more people will be moved from areas affected by high levels of contamination from the Chernobyl disaster. At least 100,000 people were evacuated from the region in the immediate aftermath of the explosion and fire at Chernobyl in 1986. A defense consultant today was sentenced to 27 months in prison for his role in a scheme to bribe a Navy engineer for confidential bid information about Pentagon contracts. Fred Lackner was also fined $25,000. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jose Torres, is both a former boxing champion and a writer. From 1967 to 69, he held the world light heavyweight title. And from 1983 to 88, he was the chair of the New York State Athletic Commission, which regulates boxing in New York. Throughout his prize-fighting career, Torres was managed by Cus D'Amato, the man he calls the world's greatest boxing professor. D'Amato also trained world heavyweight champ Mike Tyson. It was through D'Amato that Torres first met Tyson back in 1979 when Tyson was 12 and in reform school. Jose Torres has written a new biography of Tyson called Fire and Fear. Some of the exploits Tyson describes in the book are so extreme that they've made the news. He told Torres that the best punch he ever delivered was to Robin Givens, and he described a night when he had sex with 24 women. I asked Torres if he took the story at face value or if he had a responsibility to try to separate fact from macho exaggeration.
He told me the following day when it happened. I happened to see him the day after, and he told me, and I said, yeah, I believe you. Yeah, that's right. And that's it. You know, he was a little mad that I did not believe the story. And that happened months before I began to write the book. So when I began to do the interviews for the book with a tape recorder, then I reminded him of that part. And then this time he was able to call a witness, Rory Holloway, who confirmed his story about 24 women. And it is funny because the other day someone asked me if he had reached the climax with the 24, and I said to the guy, I don't know about that, but I'll tell you one thing. His fights, his orgasm lasts longer than his fights, I said to him. In any event, I believe the story. I don't know if there were 24 women, though. It could have been 10. You know, Ryan O'Neill was mad. You know, he's a good friend of mine, the actor, Ryan O'Neill.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was in a boxing movie that you consulted for.
That's right. Yeah. He was mad. I said, why? He said, he broke my record. I said, how much was your record? He said, 2. So we're making fun of all that. Now, about hitting Robin, I felt that it was a responsibility of mine to expose that situation, because I am one of the many writers who have been very concerned about the abuse of women in our society. And I felt that the heavyweight champion of the world, as a symbol, you know, expressed that malady in our society. And I felt it was my obligation as a professional and objective writer to do that. And I felt that Tyson told me those stories because I felt that he wanted to get them out of his system, and also because I felt he was capable of overcoming those ills.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm interested in hearing about your life as well. I was wondering if you learned to fight before you actually got into the ring.
It's amazing. I was from a middle class family within the subculture of poverty in Puerto Rico, you know, in Ponce.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we were very, very poor, but my father used to work every single day, 10 hours a day, to support his children. And at that time, when I was about 17, I decided to go into the Army. And I went to the Army, and as soon as I was there, I knew I had made a mistake. I knew that I could not live far from my family and my mother and father. And I became very depressed. And I was dizzy, like drunk, every day. I was so depressed. And then one day I asked about what can I do to get away from KP, you know, to work in the kitchen, and to stand guard. They told me, well, if you play any sports, you can do that. I said, yeah, I play baseball. So he said, the baseball season is over. I said, well, I play basketball. They said, the basketball season is over. So I said, what is the season now? They said, boxing. I said, I box.
So you boxed in the Army. Then you won the silver medal at the 1956 Olympics in Melbourne.
Right.
Then you moved to New York to train with Cus D'Amato, who was the same trainer who trained Mike Tyson.
That's true. And Floyd Patterson.
Right. Now, what makes him so special?
He was special because he was not in the game to make money. He was in the game to help young children. And also because of his unique way in teaching fighters. He felt that what made the difference at the end was not the physical mechanism, but the intelligence and the character of the person. And that alone, I mean, that was so attractive to me because for the first time, I discovered that I was a normal human being when I used to get scared stiff before each fight. He taught me that I was normal. He said, if you did not get scared, I would not want you to fight for me. I want normal human beings because normal human beings can be taught. I said, but if a guy comes to me fearless, I feel this guy's too dumb to learn how to win and become champion of the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say in your biography of Mike Tyson that Cus D'Amato didn't think that sex and boxing were incompatible. He encouraged you to bring your wife to where you were training on weekends, which I guess was pretty unusual for the time. Are the two still considered incompatible?
Well, you know, what happened with Cus was that he knew that there was no medical explanation to justify the suspicion of many athletes who said that sex weakens the legs or weakens your arms and makes you weak. And Cus never believed that. Cus feels that in order for any young boy to become champion of the world, he has to master the fear and master his emotions. He cannot allow any emotion to get the best of him. He felt that since boxers are young, healthy, and in tremendous condition, that the need of sex is a natural thing for them. He feels that by depriving them from sex, they would develop anxiety, and anxiety is an emotion out of control. And he said the only and best way to relieve the boxer from that uncontrolled emotion is to have sex. So he felt that sex then worked on behalf of the fighter.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Jose Torres, and he's the former world light heavyweight champion. He's also the former head of the New York State Athletic Commission, which regulates boxing in New York, and the author of a new biography of Mike Tyson called Fire and Fear. After you won a few middleweight bouts, D'Amato held you back. He didn't give you any significant fights for, I think, about a year. Why was he holding you back like that?
Okay, at the time, Cus D'Amato was engaged in a big fight against the boxing establishment that was being controlled by unscrupulous men at the time, all over the country. And he began to fight them, to buck them. And he used the heavyweight champion of the world, Floyd Patterson, to do that. And he used me. In the process, I was hurt a lot, but I was aware that I was hurt. But I had an interest beyond my own personal one. I felt that Cus convinced me that we together could help boxing in general, and that every young kid coming up today and after me, they would be helped by this struggle against the boxing establishment at the time. So I suffered a lot. I became champion at age 28 instead of at age 22 or 23. You know, I was ready then. But the establishment would not give me a chance to fight in retaliation for what Cus was doing to them. And of course, I, you know, in the final, at the end, cause had destroyed the boxing establishment. They put like people in jail for that after cause finished with them. And it was a lot of bad people at the time.
During that period when you weren't fighting, people thought that you had disappeared, maybe because you were a coward. Was that hard to take?
No, because there were only few people who thought so. The boxing community knew what was going on. They knew that Cuss was in this fight and that I was backing Cuss. And even though we had arguments, I there were points in which I told Cuss that I was being hurt too bad, that I might never become champion. And Cuss says that age doesn't make champions, that old age had not been established in boxing, all that stuff. And I thought that as a matter of principle and integrity and honesty, Cuss was right. Mm-hmm. And I felt that I had to back him up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about boxing, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Jose Torres, and he's written a new biography of Mike Tyson. He's a former boxer. Torres is a former boxer, and we'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Jose Torres is my guest. He was the world light heavyweight champion from 1965 to 67. From 1983 to 88, he was the chair of the New York State Athletic Commission, which regulates boxing in New York. Torres is also a writer. His new book is a biography of Mike Tyson called Fire and Fear. Let's talk a little bit about what it's like in the ring. Is learning to take pain part of the art of boxing?
That's automatic. We don't think about pain. The punch that knocks you out, you don't feel the punch. Pain, usually, you feel it when you are hit in the body, like in the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. But you train so hard that the pain is beyond recognition. You don't recognize pain. You are so full of determination and will that you don't think about pain. The pain that you suffer in boxing is not physical pain, but mental pain, when you are so afraid of losing, afraid of humiliation, being humiliated, more than anything else. That's why in the gym nation, you don't care about getting hit. Fighters get hurt much more in gym nations than they do in actual fight. Because, first of all, actual fights are very few. In the gym nation, you box every single day, training.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there's no pressure of humiliation in the gym. So you don't care about getting hit. You take more chances in the gym,
mm-hmm.
in the fight, because of the public pressure. You are afraid to be humiliated. And, psychologically, it becomes very painful.
Well, you mentioned humiliation. I wonder what it feels like when you're hit hard and your opponent's fans are cheering.
And also, when you... I think that fighters know before it happens when they're going to lose. I think they have a feeling, that the fighters that loses their will to win in the midst of the fight. That's why Muhammad Ali was such a great fighter. Muhammad Ali was one of the few who won fights, perhaps most of his fights, before he went into the ring. He used to discourage his opponent. And the opponent would go into the ring thinking that they were going to lose. And that was a magic that super great champions have,
What's the worst punch you ever took?
The best punch I ever took, it had to be, I was hit very hard maybe four times in my whole career, very hard. And I was never really hurt, but I was stunned those four times. And usually they happened with fighters who could not punch, who were not recognized as good punchers. And subconsciously you take more chances with guys that don't punch. So I got hit by them because I took more chances. But punchers never hit me, with exception when I was coming up, of Florentino Fernandez, who knocked me down with one punch. That was the only punch he hit me with. I was not stunned because I was like unconscious for about 1 to 2 seconds. You know, I don't remember going to the floor, but I remember when I hit the floor. And I turned toward my family, you know, my mother, my father was there, and my wife was there. And I looked at them just to tell them that I was okay. And then I got up, and I was beating him, and then something happened that I could not throw punches, you know. I was like a delayed reaction, eventually, you know, 4 rounds later, and the referee stopped the fight. But I learned a lot that time. But that was, I think that was the best punch I have ever been hit with, because I went down.
Mm-hmm.
But it was no pain, though, and I didn't feel... I describe being stunned with getting a million ants into your body and then coming out. And I didn't feel that in that fight. I felt that 3 times with other fighters, but not with, you know, not the time that I got knocked down.
What was it like being knocked down, hearing the referee's count while struggling to get back on your feet?
Well, I see, I was not struggling because I was okay.
I see, okay.
But I can imagine, though, that it's... Wait a minute. Later on, that happened to me.
It did?
I forgot that part. My last fight, I was hit not with a good punch. I was hit with the bell. You know, the bell and the punch at the same time. And I went down and I got up. And the referee was counting. And I was conscious, but I had no control over my legs. And that's when at that moment... I knew I would never fight again. And I went to the corner, and I came back in the second round, and I knocked the other guy out. And that was it. I never boxed again. But that was humiliating. That was very embarrassing. I didn't want to look at the crowd. I didn't want to look at none of my brothers who were there, or my father. I was so embarrassed to be down. And I felt that no one would ever get that chance again. And that was my last fight.
What year was that?
1969, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
My guest is Jose Torres. You're also the former head of the New York State Athletic Commission, which regulates boxing. When you were in that position, were there any trends that you saw that especially disturbed you, that you thought were having a bad effect on the sport?
Well, the only thing that I was very careful about was conflict of interest in terms of Tyson. I was too close to Tyson, and I was afraid that my emotions would get the best of me because I didn't care. I used to root for Tyson when he was fighting, but not in New York. In New York, I would be very, very, very objective. And also, I would put the best officials to work because I knew they would not be influenced by my friendship with Tyson. But going to Atlantic City and Las Vegas and other places where Tyson boxed, I used to go to the dressing room. I used to give him advice, and that was not, you know, completely kosher, as they said here in New York.
Mm-hmm.
It was one thing I want to make sure, and that is that if Tyson boxed in New York, I used to wish that the fight would end by KO. Because if Tyson was engaged in a close fight and he got the close fight, I would have been under incredible criticism because of my friendship. So I was always hoping for Tyson to knock the guy out.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have to have that conflict. But it was also bureaucracy bothered me. It was fun at the beginning. At the end, it became too bureaucratic. And I quit to write the book, and I'm very happy.
Your new book is a biography of Mike Tyson. Now, I can't think of many boxers who have had second careers as writers. I know that when you started boxing professionally, you were friends with the writers Pete Hamill and Norman Mailer. Were they influential on your early writing and on what you were reading at the time?
Well, not only educated, not influential. I mean, they were the reason for me. I mean, Pete Hamill gave me every single book. I mean, Pete Hamill gave me the first book I ever had in my life. And he gave me the second book and the third book. You know, he gave me like 200 or 300 books. And I was reading all the time. I have never read a book other than a text, you know, book from in school. Never read a novel, never read anything until I met Pete. And that was when I was 20. And Pete got me to read. And then he got me to write. I mean, Pete was the guy, the person who was responsible for me to read and to write, you know. But he was the one. And then, of course, Norman Mailer came later because Pete introduced me to Norman Mailer. And Pete introduced me to Bud Schulberg. And they began to help me, you know. At one point, when I wrote another book called Sting Like a Bee, the biography of Muhammad Ali in 1971. Well, I went to Vermont to live a mile away from Norman Mailer, who I'm sure gave up $2 million just to help me with this book. You know, we exchange. I pay him by teaching him how to box, and he was editing my book, you know, and we worked together for 2.5 months, and I finished my book there with him, changed the book around, and he went there for a project that he ignored, and it cost him maybe, I don't know, minimum $2 million, maybe $5 million.
I want to ask you about the inscription in your new biography of Mike Tyson. You write, "To each and every one of my Puerto Rican compatriots who is still struggling to have a free mind and act in accordance with his best judgment, rid yourself of the colonial mentality." What do you mean there, and how does that apply to your experiences?
Okay, I feel that the lack of progress, of significant progress of my people, as a people, because, you know, we have many individuals, but as a people, we're still at the bottom of the totem pole, economically, you know, socially. I think that's due in part to the inculcation of the controllers of Puerto Rico, you know, the American establishment. They reduce our determination to get ahead. We have what I consider a colonial mentality based on subtle inculcation that we are not, you know, in the same level as any other human being. In Puerto Rico, for example, if you go to the market and you see small tomatoes and big tomatoes, usually we call the big tomato an American tomato and the small tomato the Puerto Rican tomato. You know, we see a baby that is born, and he says, "How beautiful this baby is." He looks American because he had blue eyes and light skin, stuff like that. So I think that we have to rid ourselves of that mentality, thinking that there are other peoples who are better than us. Mm-hmm. And some individuals have been able to overcome that, you know, and supersede that. But most of us, we're still in that state of mind, you know.
I have one last question before we have to wrap up.
Okay.
Has your weight changed much since you stopped boxing and since you don't have to maintain yourself in a certain weight category?
You're going
to
be surprised. And I don't know if this is a... but I developed a little bit of diabetes about 1 year ago when I began having trouble with this book with Mike Tyson and his wife and his mother-in-law. I developed diabetes, and it got a little worse. I would probably have to start taking insulin and taking pills. And I have been under some control, but because I like to eat bread, it goes up a little bit. Anyhow, because of that condition, I lost 15 pounds in the last year and a half, which has been a blessing in disguise. But, I mean, the reason is not good. But the fact that I lost 15 pounds, people think that I look as small as I did when I was a fighter. But I'm still 185, 186. And when I used to fight, I used to weigh 174.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your life. Thank you.
A pleasure.
Jose Torres has been my guest. His new book is a biography of Mike Tyson called Fire and Fear. It's published by Warner Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's blues musician John Hammond. Coming up, he plays some Delta blues. Also, in the mid-1980s, a child in Kokomo, Indiana, was barred from public school because he had AIDS. At the same time, a child with AIDS in Massachusetts was welcomed back to his school. David Kerp has studied how communities respond to children with AIDS, and he says it shows the best and worst in human nature. And commentator Stuart Brand takes us into the world of cyberspace. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. Iran says the Israeli abduction of three militants in southern Lebanon was a shameless act, and it will be avenged. Early this morning, Israeli commandos captured three members of the pro-Iranian Hezbollah, including a clergyman believed to have planned the 1988 abduction of U.S. Marine Colonel William Higgins in Lebanon. President Bush said today that he doesn't know if the incident will help Higgins. The president added, "Kidnapping and violence won't help to establish peace in the Middle East." It's not been a good week on Capitol Hill for President Bush, where he's faced several legislative setbacks. Today, the president appeared in the White House briefing room to talk about those setbacks. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
Congress will not get high marks from him, President Bush told reporters crowded into the briefing room. The House voted to cut four defense programs he favors, the Midget Man, the Rail-MX, SDI, and the B-2 stealth bomber. He said he would not accept further cuts.
I am disappointed that the House did what they did. We have a defense secretary who has made some tough cuts and set some priorities and done which many have failed to do, and that is to cut out some systems.
Bush is facing other legislative setbacks. House Senate conferees rejected his savings and loan bailout plan. He predicted his plan would prevail. And Bush's nominee for the top civil rights job in the Justice Department, Bill Lucas, came under sharp attack during confirmation hearings. The president said he is behind Lucas 100%. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
Senior Chinese leaders have promised that they and their families will give up some of the privileges enjoyed by those in high office. From Beijing, Tim Luard has details.
The series of measures announced after a meeting of the ruling Politburo appeared to be intended as a direct response to calls for an end to corruption and nepotism made during the recent pro-democracy unrest. National television said the measures included an end to leaders eating special food or receiving gifts or lavish banquets, a ban on foreign trips except for working or official visits, and tight controls on the use of foreign cars. Their families were to be banned from taking part in any commercial business. A firm that's been closely associated with the handicapped son of senior leader Deng Xiaoping, the Kanghua Development Company, would be broken up, said the announcement, and many other companies were to be investigated. After weeks of fierce official criticism of the pro-democracy demonstrations as a counter-revolutionary rebellion, the leadership has now made at least a gesture towards addressing one of the students' main demands.
The BBC's Tim Luard. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost a fraction of a point today to close at 2635.24. Advances led declines with about 180 million shares. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Blues musician John Hammond has mastered many different styles, including slide guitar. The sound is usually achieved by putting a cylinder of glass or metal over a finger of your chording hand and sliding it over the neck of an open-tuned guitar. The first song Hammond's going to play is with a slide. The song is Preachin' the Blues, and it's by Sunhouse, who is one of the pioneers of Delta blues.
Join the Baptist church. Ooh, I I'm a given religion, darling. Ooh, I'm a join the Baptist church. Said I'll be a Baptist preacher, hey, and I sure won't have to work. Ooh, I had me religion, darling. Little girl, and it's every day. Ooh, I had me religion, darling. Ooh, child, and it's every day. But you know the women and whiskey, ooh, child, it sure don't let me pray. I wish I had me, baby. I'd be in a heaven of my own. Ooh, I wish I had me, baby. Ooh, child, a heaven of my own. I give all these women I'm loving such, such a long, old, happy home. To jump straight up and down.
When I was very young, the first blues singer that I heard, that I actually saw and figured out in my mind, this is a blues singer, was Big Bill Brunzi, and he was one of the great ambassadors of blues music. He went all over the world, and he was just a fantastic human being. And one of the songs that he did a lot was The Key to the Highway, which is, I don't know if he wrote it, but that's where I got it from, and it goes something like this.
I've got the key to the highway. Fill out, baby, well, I'm bound to go. You know I'ma leave here running cold. Baby, walking's most too slow. I'm going back on the border. Honey, where I'm better known. No, you haven't done nothing but drove. I mean a good man away from home. Now when the moon peeps over the mountain, honey, I'll be on my way. I got to roam this highway. I mean until the break of day. Give me one more kiss, darling. Honey, just before I go. Cause when I leave this time, girl, I won't be back no more. I said it's so long, baby. Honey, I must say goodbye. I I got to roam this highway, I mean until the day I die. I've got the key to the highway. Bill, I, baby, well, I'm bound to go, 'cause you know I'm gonna leave here running cold. 'Cause baby walk is most too slow.
John Hammond will be back with us later this summer. His new album, Nothing But You, is on the Flying Fish label. This is Fresh Air. Suppose your child came home from school and told you a classmate had AIDS. How would you react? That question is at the heart of a new book by my guest David Kirp, a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. The book is called Learning by Heart, AIDS and Schoolchildren in America's Communities. Kirp spent a year studying how different communities responded to children with AIDS. He found reactions varied wildly between compassion and terror. In Kokomo, Indiana, the town leaders expelled 12-year-old Ryan White. In Arcadia, Florida, someone burnt down the home of a family whose three children tested positive. But in Swansea, Massachusetts, the town embraced Mark Hoyle and became the first community to voluntarily let a child with AIDS into public school. Kirp told me why the citizens of Swansea reacted so differently.
Critical to the decision in that town was the nature of the community itself and the nature of the people who led it in this tough time. Swansea is a small place where lots of people know each other. It's a town of 15,000. It's a town that's led by a superintendent who'd been off and on a teacher and principal and administrator for almost 30 years, who'd been everybody's coach or English teacher, a man named Jack McCarthy. And McCarthy decided that when he heard that there was this boy, Mark, with AIDS, that he was going to learn as much as he could about the disease. He had a kind of Newsweek reader's knowledge of the disease. And he learned. He called the people at the Centers for Disease Control. They were just about to put out the first AIDS guidelines for schools. They said, there's no problem. He talked to the state epidemiologist in Massachusetts, who sort of broke through the bureaucratic logjam there and said, absolutely, you should go ahead and admit this boy to school. And with that, McCarthy, who is someone who really likes taking decisions, decided this was the thing to do.
The same information was available to the residents of Swansea about AIDS as was available to the residents of Kokomo, Swansea being the school that admitted the student with AIDS, Kokomo being the city where the student was turned away. What are some of the factors in the community, do you think, that explain for the differences in how they reacted to the students in question with AIDS?
Well, some of the obvious factors that I thought, as somebody who spends part of his time as an academic and part of his time as a journalist, weren't there. It isn't that Swansea is a particularly liberal town or a cosmopolitan town or anything of the sort. They're really very similar kinds of places in lots of ways. A lot of the difference resides in the nature of leadership in the two towns. Nobody in Kokomo, Indiana, dreamed of calling anybody outside of Howard County. The state hadn't done anything, and that was enough for J.O. Smith, a kind of good country boy who was, unlike his counterpart in Swansea, new to the job and insecure. And when he heard from his dentist that the idea of having a kid with AIDS in school was scary, that was almost enough for him. And then what happens? So that you get a real parochialism setting in, and then what happens when the parents, when Jeannie White and Ryan White and eventually their lawyers take on the system, the whole situation hardens. So even as more knowledge is coming out all the time, even as yet more facts are emerging that ought to persuade a reasonable person that Ryan White is just a 13-year-old boy with a terrible disease who needs compassion and caring and not to be kicked out of school, nobody could listen, because by then it really was us versus them. By then, everybody in Kokomo feels they're up against it, that the world is against them, and they just can't listen to anything that anybody is saying.
You visited these towns after the decisions were made to accept or reject a student with AIDS. Do you think they would stand by the decisions if they had to make them again?
You get very different reactions if you go to a town which has welcomed a child with AIDS and you go to a town which has really fought against this. In the towns like Swansea, and there are numbers of them around the country, people are falling over themselves to tell you everything they did. They are proud. They think of this as defining who they are at their best. At the places like Kokomo and like the little town of Osceola, Georgia, that got so scared about AIDS that it kept a child who was HIV negative, not only didn't have AIDS, didn't have the virus, out of school because his mother was a carrier. In that kind of town, people are defensive, they're unhappy, they feel a bit of shame, and they hide the story from you.
In each of these instances, it was a local decision. It was made by the individual school. As an expert in public policy, do you think that there ought to be some kind of state or national policy that applies to how schools should deal with students who have AIDS?
It would have made life easier for everybody if there were not only national standards, as there are guidelines that the Centers for Disease Control has put out, but if there really was some leadership coming from states and particularly from Washington. I imagine what might have happened when in the aftermath of the burning of a house in Arcadia, Florida, one of the most notorious events, when three HIV-infected boys went to school and their house was burned down and they were driven out of town. If Ronald Reagan had actually had one of those fireside chats about how AIDS isn't transmitted and had had the Ray boys on the show with him and had really hugged them, how powerful a message that would have been. So not only leadership, but in the rule sense, but leadership in the symbolic sense of we care, we're with you, would have made life infinitely easier. As it was, people really were on their own, and it was hard.
What about leadership in the rule sense, though? Do you think we need rules on a state or a national level applying to AIDS?
Well, by now we have something close to rules. We have the CDC guidelines, and we have a number of court decisions that exist. Mm-hmm. And yes, I think rules might make these decisions even more routine.
So between the CDC guidelines and the court precedents that have been set, which way would a school be likely to go now?
I think most schools will try to keep the AIDS and children issue as quiet, as muffled as they can. That's what I get from talking to school administrators around the country. It's what I get when I talk to the people in the Hemophilia Association. Either administrators will say, keep your kid out of school, because if you don't, I can't guarantee that your house isn't going to be burned down and you're not going to be driven out of town. Or they'll say, it's okay to come, but keep it quiet. Very, very few places are willing to discuss the issue. We were talking about tens of children in 1985 when the Ryan White story and Kokomo and the Mark Hoyle story and Swansea were unfolding. We're talking about hundreds of kids now. We're talking about an estimated 20,000 cases of kids with AIDS by the end of 1991. And the reason those stories aren't being told isn't that AIDS has become routine. It's that people are so afraid to talk about it in schools because they see Kokomo on television, they see that burning house in Arcadia, and they don't want it to happen to them.
The population now that's being hardest hit by AIDS are non-whites, blacks and Hispanics. Many of the people with AIDS now are people who are intravenous drug users, and many babies are being born with AIDS. Do you think that that the kind of changing demographics in AIDS is going to affect the way that they're treated? And in fact, how sympathetically they're going to be treated.
It's the question with which I end the book, and I do so because you move in these stories from the kind of poster kid. Ryan White and Mark Hoyle are the March of Dimes kids for AIDS, and it's hard not to fall in love with them. It's harder for many Americans to fall in love with the abandoned children of a drug-using mother who drops the kid off in a hospital in Southeast Bronx and disappears someplace. But I think the challenge is the same. I think if people can learn from the stories that their fears are very much the same. They're still kids, and they're kids with needs and concerns and their kids who have lives ahead of them. And the kid stories, in turn, aren't so very different from the grown-up stories. So if there's a hope for the stories that are told in the book, is that people can rehearse in their own minds and hearts what it is that in a dozen or so communities around the country parents went through and teachers went through and others went through, and can learn that this isn't just a story about somebody else, this is a story about us. It's not just a story about cute white kids, but it's a story about who we are as people, and who we are as people is going to be determined powerfully by how we respond when someone who's been part of our community, part of our lives, says, let me stay here even though I have this scary disease.
You start your book with this question. You say, imagine for a moment that your own 8-year-old came home from school and told you a classmate had AIDS. How would you react, keeping in mind that you're going to be told that there's an infinitesimally small risk that your child could catch AIDS from this child? But it's not a zero risk. It's just an infinitesimally small one. I'm sure you've asked yourself that question. Has your answer to that ever changed? Has your answer always been, of course?
No, I've always hesitated at that question, and it's the gulp in the question that I think gives the issue its charge, its drama. I've never posed that question to anybody, myself or anybody else, who didn't pause at least for a moment and say, gosh, that's different from thinking about AIDS policy out there. It's as intimate as the question can be. And writing the book and working on the book was partly an enterprise in understanding what made for good communities and bad communities and what made for the possibility of successful policy. Part of the book was really an exploration and excavation of my own heart and feelings. And that level of feeling what those people went through is a learning process that I rehearsed during the day and in lots of dreams besides.
So you're confident now of what your answer would be to that question?
My answer would be yes, not only because this child with AIDS does not pose a real risk to my child, would I say, yes, that child should be there. It's another level of an answer. If I say, no, that child shouldn't be there, I am creating a much greater risk, and that risk is that I'm teaching my child a terrible lesson. It's the lesson that when you don't like something, what you do is you exclude it, you get rid of it, you banish it, you blame it, you point fingers at it. And I think that risk, the risk of teaching a moral wrong to kids, is so much greater, even if so much ignored, that it makes for me, by now, having lived with these stories for several years, an easy question.
David Kirp, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
David Kirp is the author of Learning by Heart, AIDS and School Children in America's Communities. It's published by Rutgers University Press. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We're going to take a look at a kind of bad week for the president. He's not only had a spy scandal breaking around him, but last night the House rejected his defense budget. We're also going to hear about California water. The farmers in the Central Valley's contract for the water that irrigates that area is up for renewal. Environmentalists don't want it renewed. Farmers say it has to be. And in the Middle East, there's some very uncomfortable news. The Israelis have kidnapped a man believed to have been behind the taking of one of the American hostages.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Commentator Stuart Brand is always scouting out new technologies and inventions. Today he introduces us to a gizmo that lets you travel without ever leaving your chair.
A couple of weeks ago, I saw the future of media. In fact, I flew in it. It was at the Ames Research Center in California, run by NASA, where I got to experience a new device called a head-mounted display unit. Here's how it works. You go into this rather small room, and your guide puts a kind of complicated rig on your head. It's not heavy or uncomfortable. But you may be nervous, because you know that when the apparatus on the front of it is swiveled down in front of your eyes, you'll enter another world. It's an instant transformation. One moment you're in the room, the next moment you're in a different room. It's a visual computer simulation of the room your body is in. Very crude, but it's strangely believable. The room is three-dimensional, and the thing is, you can look around in it and even move around in it. What you're really looking at are two tiny TV screens, one for each eye. That gives the 3D effect. And there's a position indicator on your head that tells the computer where you are and what direction you're looking. So, when you turn your head to the left, the display pans with you and shows you what you would see to the left. When you walk forward, your point of view travels forward. It's very convincing, because even though the image is crude, the fact that it responds to your body makes you believe in it. This is what's called virtual reality. That's the term computer people use for computer-simulated environments. A science fiction writer, William Gibson, coined another term, cyberspace, which is being used for virtual realities like this in which you immerse yourself. There in cyberspace with you is your right hand, which is sensed by another device called a data glove. You can hold the display hand up in front of you and flex its fingers. You can reach out and grasp things, virtual things that exist only in the simulated room, and move them around. Your hand also can give commands in this virtual reality. If you make a fist and then point your forefinger, you slowly fly in the direction you're pointing. If you point up, you rise through the ceiling of the room, and you can see the room diminishing in the distance below you, becoming a little box. Point down, and you soar back into it. The universal experience is glee. I felt like an angel, completely out of my body. I mean, my body was working fine as a command instrument back there in real reality, but wherever I was somewhere else. No one wants to come out of these demonstrations. Everyone wants to explore and try stuff and keep flying. And soon they'll be able to, because the technology is coming to the public much more quickly than anyone expected. The important thing about NASA's cyberspace rig is that it's cheap, only $30,000 or so for the prototype. That's in contrast to the multi-million dollar systems being developed by the military for fighter pilots. The quick and dirty approach at NASA was developed as a shortcut to the planets. The head of the program, Michael McGreevy, figured that if he demonstrated how cheap cyberspace could be, then consumer electronic manufacturers would run with the idea, and in a few years he could buy their equipment and fly it to Mars for remotely controlled exploration. So far, his plan is working beautifully. Personal computer software companies are seizing the cyberspace idea and devising commercial products, some of which should be out as early as next year and cost only a few thousand dollars. You'd think that people in the entertainment industry would be the first to grab something like this, which could represent a whole new dimension for them, but I suspect they'll be the last. They don't like media that move quickly, and they don't like revolutions, and cyberspace is both.
Stuart Brand is founder of the Whole Earth Catalog. His latest book is The Media Lab, Inventing the Future at MIT. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Ed Doherty. Naomi Person produces the music reviews and arts commentaries. Steve Plever joined us as production assistant this week, and Lisa Bruton directed today's program. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, veteran journalist Otto Friedrich gives a lesson from the old days on how to cover a war without getting within 1,000 miles of it. Also, a talk with world-renowned French hornist Barry Tuckwell. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.